conservatism as borders, language, and culture. Tens of millions of libertarians agree with me. They say they believe in these three principles, but they just don't want anyone telling them how to live. I do not know a better definition today of what conservatism is than mine. Just as left-wing pedantic academics, putzfessers such as Barry Obama, are running the country into the ground while they hold offices in the executive branch, right-wing pedantic academics are sapping our ability to fight back. Ironically, I understand the historical conservatives like Burke and Buckley better than they do. Like all academics, they can squeak out isolated historical details in their thin little voices, but they miss the forest for the trees. The conservative forest has always been borders, language, and culture. Edmund Burke did not face the same challenges we do today. Burke was a legislator in the British Parliament in the 18th century when the British Empire was expanding. He supported the empire, but was critical of the king or his ministers whenever they destroyed local cultures and customs. He understood, as I do today, that the essence of conservatism is borders, language, and culture. That's why Burke opposed the East India Tea Company's actions during the First Anglo-Maratha War. The British had facilitated the destruction of not only the infrastructure of an entire region of India, but of long-standing customs that were essential to the social and economic stability of the region as well. Burke understood that destroying the local pillars of civilization as it existed in India at the time would not benefit the British Empire. Did avowed conservatives such as George W. Bush and Dick Cheney understand that when they dismantled Iraq and left the pieces to be consumed by the ISIS dogs? Burke's support of the American Revolution was based on the same principles. He supported the empire's rule over the American colonies, but he opposed the same thing the American colonists opposed in 1775. Parliament destroying long-standing legal customs by imposing new taxes and laws when the colonies had previously reserved that authority for themselves. Eliminating those cherished legal traditions was an attack on American culture at the time, just as the progressives' attack on private property and free enterprise is an assault today. Buckley also defended borders, language, and culture during his time, which was largely during the Cold War. The United States faced substantial threats from international communism abroad and virtually unopposed progressivism in all areas of popular culture at home. Remember, this was before conservative talk radio, when the media were uniformly liberal. The few brave conservative voices on radio and TV, men such as Joe Pyne and Alan Burke, were considered the lunatic fringe. To help defend traditional American culture, Buckley founded the National Review. In the face of communist revolutions all over the world and liberal coups, such as the Great Society at home, Buckley defended America's borders, language, and culture by promoting a more libertarian, laissez-faire economy at home and energetic support for anti-communist movements abroad. Those were the means to protect America's borders, language, and culture in his day. Buckley was in his mid-70s on September 11, 2001, and he died in 2008. He lived long enough to realize that the Iraq War was a tragic mistake, as I did at the time. But he didn't live to see what it and Hillary Clinton's support of the Arab Spring produced: ISIS and the all-out invasion of the West by Muslim refugees and terrorists. And just as the means of defending America's borders, language, and culture were different for Buckley during the Cold War than they were for Burke during the American colonial period, our means must be different in defending them against the progressive Islamist takeover we face today. Conservatives, take note. Expand your inclusiveness by shrinking your definitions. Let Donald Trump or any other self-described conservative politician stand shoulder to shoulder with three simple words. Borders, language, culture. Conservatives are defining themselves to death. I was thinking about including a chapter on immigration, not the legal kind that my family undertook, the other kind. We all know it's a vitally important subject, but then I realized that immigration should be in every chapter and not a standalone chapter. Then I thought about one aspect of immigration that needs to be singled out. If we allow our borders to fall, will there be anything of conservatism left? Wrong things, wrong people get in. Look around you. It's a process that started years ago. There are those on the so-called right wing who think they're the Pope of conservatism, who say that Donald Trump's not pure enough because he's not a social conservative. This kind of attitude was the exact attitude that predominated in Russia after the Communist Revolution, where they all started arguing that certain people weren't pure enough communists, remember? They talked about counter-revolutionaries. Early in the Republican presidential nomination process this past cycle, I was told I had made the wrong choice. The pundits attacked me. Trump's not a conservative, they said. If Savage supports him, then he is not a conservative. Only Cruz is the real thing. At the time, I said that this is the kind of limited thinking that you get out of the communist, and I believe it's truer now. We've got to get rid of conservatism as an idea. It's dead. What we need is nationalism. Let me take you back to when I was first thinking about this book and talking about what should be the first chapter. My first thought was that we should start by answering the question, what is a conservative? I figured that would lay the groundwork for everything that came after. Then, I started thinking about the Iranian antiques dealer who was thrown into jail, the one I told you about at the start of this book. He was locked up for having the wrong political ideas, not for trying to kill people. He was a victim of the same kind of thinking that conservatives are using on the rest of us. But I realized something more insidious. While we fight each other, we are wide open to deadlier attacks from the left. Imagine what would have happened during the American Civil War if Great Britain or Mexico or Spain had attacked us. Imagine if we'd had a Hillary Clinton on our side. She'd have been the great attorney appeaser seeking reconciliation. Can you even begin to compare her to Abigail Adams, who was nearly as vested in independency as her husband, our second president? For that matter, can you imagine what Bill Clinton would have been doing in Philadelphia while Hillary was back in Massachusetts? It wouldn't have been serving on the Declaration Committee, I can tell you that. There were only men in the Continental Congress. This debate about conservatism is an idiotic sideshow. It's a useless distraction that has to stop. We are better than that. Do you understand? Let me repeat, we are better than that. We do not need these trivial debates. They have always been distractions since the days of the Founding Fathers. People fought duels over ideology, but it rarely had anything to do with who we are, with our core identity as Americans. Uniquely, we have the ability to harness that identity and conquer the plains, or split the atom, or go to the moon, or create goods the world desires. That is one of our greatest strengths, if not the greatest. What we should do, what a President Trump should do, is investigate all these liberal groups, not just Facebook and the IRS. A Trump administration should monitor all American mosques, stop everyone who is trying to subvert our country. Would that be conservative enough for you? we need to do something about what the left has done to the country. It's trying to own us. That's more than ideas. I've seen it waiting for the Supreme Court. It has damaged virtually every aspect of our government. What's wrong with something like the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, like they had in the 1950s? Why is that a violation of anyone's rights? In Chapter 2, I published a long list, a very important list, of all the groups, the subversive groups, that are attacking us today. Every one of them is a dangerous, nihilistic group that has been set up specifically to violate the Constitution and undermine our republic. The only way of stopping them is first to expose them. Conservatives, stop fighting about definitions. Save the nation. First, we have to say it can happen here. Here are the subversive groups. Here is what we must do. First, unmask them. Then hold committee hearings under the new administration and investigate their money sources. Definitions. How do they matter in the face of real danger? You want to define something? We expose the groups that subvert, that are clearly set up to subvert the will of the people. They are an active minority of radical communist Marxists who usurp the entire meaning of democracy. They've literally railroaded their agenda down our throats. We have to unmask them, so we've been doing that by naming them. We've called out the subversive groups. We've named them. We're shaming them. Call it name 'em and shame 'em. We're going to show, in a short couple of paragraphs, what each has done. We're going to demand that there be a congressional investigation of all those subversive groups with regard to their funding. We're going to find out how many of them have received federal funds, how many have received private funds from illegitimate sources. Notice that I didn't say we should throw them in jail. I said let's expose them and expose their funding. That's as far as I'll go. If jail is merited, if the government's going to investigate that possibility at all, it first has to find evidence of a crime. And guess what? If those groups are getting funding by breaking campaign finance laws and other financial laws, we're clearly there. If they have committed other crimes, we'll find that out too. Conservatives, dismantle the circular firing squad. Turn your fire outward so we can start to restore what is dearest in American society. The real Constitution. When I talk about borders, language, and culture being the bedrock of conservative thought, you may say I'm omitting things such as the Constitution. You know, the document that was apparently written by black men and not middle-aged white guys, if you believe the Broadway rap musical, Hamilton. I don't have to bang the Constitution over your head like a Bible, do I? The idea behind borders, language, and culture automatically references the Constitution. That definition of conservatism contains everything conservatives are trying to conserve. It is our borders, language, and culture that define who we are. They are the product of long traditions such as private property, individual liberty, and the rule of law. The Constitution is the result of our borders, language, and culture, not the other way around. The United States has a written constitution that defines what the government is supposed to do and how it is supposed to do it, and what limits those in power. But the smug academics who use it as a bludgeon don't seem to understand why the founding fathers wanted a written constitution in the first place. To prevent the government from destroying America's borders, language, and culture, the way so many tyrannical governments had in the past. The Constitution, a document that the constitutional scholar Barack Hussein Obama has fought hard to suppress, strictly defined what the government would do and forbade it to do anything else, which is why Obama has worked around it and through it, shredding it along the way. The Founding Fathers, I refuse to use the currently fashionable word founders, which I guess is meant to be inclusive of women and slaves, the Founding Fathers wrote it the way they did for one reason, one incontrovertible reason, because they were conservatives. Chapter 7. Our Shame. Watching sailors apologize for being captured. It was a mistake. That was our fault, and we apologize for our mistake. Your GPS said that you had penetrated to Iran territorial water. I believe so. How was the Iranian behavior with you? The Iranian behavior was fantastic while we were here. We thank you very much for your hospitality and your assistance. That was the most humiliating moment in my lifetime as an outsider, as a civilian, watching the U.S. Navy sailors seized in January 2016. I had never seen anything like it in my entire life, and even today, we don't yet have the full, humiliating, possibly criminal story. It reminded me of the propaganda films from the Korean War, when the communists would capture soldiers and torture them. The same smooth off-camera voice saying, "You are well treated by us. You have no problem?" Secretary of State John Kerry gets up and thanks them in his double-talking way, wearing his suit of ketchup with his silk tongue and his silk mouth and his silk brain, and no one in the media says anything. No one's asking these questions. Did they go aground because an EMP weapon disabled the naval boats? Did they go aground because they were off course? How could a naval boat go off course when it's manned by sailors who are so skilled at driving these things? I, as a small craft boater, have gone aground just once because I had no chart going into a harbor. It can happen to a civilian, but it's impossible to believe that it would happen to two U.S. Navy boats at once. It's impossible to believe that unless they were given the wrong charts for the area, or someone screwed with their GPS, there's no other way it could have happened. What mothership did those fast patrol boats come from? They don't launch out of the air. Some amphibious craft probably held those boats. Who's the captain? He is responsible for this. The boats were fast assault craft, CB-90 combat boats. They were originally developed by the Swedish Navy. The CB-90 is a very fast and agile boat, can turn very quickly, can decelerate from top speed to a full stop in 2.5 boat lengths. It's lightweight with a very shallow draft, which means it can go into shallow water. It runs off a jet engine, meaning twin water jets, and can run up to speeds of 40 knots, 74 kilometers an hour, in shallow coastal waters. So how did it happen? How did a boat of this advanced nature wind up going aground on an Iranian island in the Persian Gulf? How was that even possible? We were told that one of the boats had engine failure, but not why. Were the engines tampered with? Why was a major warship and air cover not immediately sent to protect the boats and tow them away from the Iranian patrol boats? No one's answering these questions. They need to be answered. They will never be answered by the cafe singer in the White House who applauded himself over and over and over again that night, creating a parallel universe the way every other dictator in history has done, talking about a paradise that doesn't exist. He went on and on and on about how wonderful the world is and how everyone who opposes him is the enemy. To the cafe singer, that silky lounge lizard, there are no enemies except the internal enemy. This is the same White House that washes its hands of ISIS and says it's nothing. They won't even say the enemy is Islamic. Every time those monsters kill somebody or blow something up, they say they're doing it in the name of Allah. They say they're doing it in the name of Islam. And he says, one of the world's religions. No, not involved at all. How's that for a big lie? Another big lie. We were warned that the day would come when big lies would be repeated over and over and over again. Hitler's propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, said, "If you tell a big lie often enough, it will become the truth." From the smallest police chief to the biggest liar in the world, the same big lie is being told, that the chaos in the world has nothing to do with religion. It's just killers and fanatics. It's nothing to do with religion, and we have nothing to fear from them. Oh, isn't Iran a Muslim theocracy? My friends, it gets worse by the day, doesn't it? Photos were released by Iran State TV from the moment the U.S. sailors were captured and bent down on their hands and knees because they wouldn't even fire a shot to save themselves. Why did they not fight it out? Why didn't they shoot their way out of that situation? They had the guns. Why didn't they use them? The whole thing was a setup. That's why. During a speech in which Obama talked about ISIS in a parallel universe, I happened to be at dinner. I tried not to watch the speech. I couldn't take it. He wouldn't even mention the word Islam. The man seems to be allied with Iran. There's no other conclusion. Either he's living in a delusional world or he's a double agent. There's no other explanation for making a speech like that. He denied what had happened in San Bernardino. He denied what had happened in Boston. He denied what had happened to the cop in Philadelphia. He denies the number of ISIS-related events. He disconnects ISIS from Islam. Every rational, literate human being on earth says they're Islamic. Even the terrorists say it. Why can't he? If this is not the work of a propagandist for the enemy, tell me, what would be the work of a propagandist for the enemy? To see the men on their hands and knees apologizing to the religious dictators who run Iran, and to see Kerry thanking Iran for returning the troops that had been delivered to Iran on a silver platter. It's clear there is something very wrong with the country under this delusional sociopath in the White House. I ask myself as I write this, will I be understood or will I be misunderstood? Can the brainwashed fools on the liberal side ever comprehend that they have been had, that their lives are being put into danger by this administration that they seem to worship so much? Ladies and gentlemen, you are witnessing the destruction of the U.S. military by the greatest enemy of our freedom. Two very advanced U.S. naval craft suddenly wander into the middle of the Persian Gulf and go aground at the same time. Our good friends in Iran, the good friends of John Kerry, rescue our sailors, but not before stealing all of our latest technology and humiliating our people. Let me tell you something, and remember it carefully. In my estimation, there is a double agent inside this. It is somebody inside the Obama administration who did this to the U.S. Navy. that agent did it to us with one of our most advanced drones 2 years ago. You may have forgotten that already because you have no press other than a few men left in the media, a few websites left where you can find the truth. Somebody in the administration sent our most advanced drone to Iran 2 years ago. It landed without a scratch, like a new Buick in a showroom. Our most advanced drone was delivered on a silver platter to the Iranians on the watch of that smiling puppet on the stage, that lying, smiling cafe singer getting away with murder and treason. The self-congratulatory speech that Barack Obama gave after that humiliating incident was in another universe. It came from somewhere else. He was living in an alternate universe. He was talking about a world that doesn't exist, and the sycophants in the Republican Party couldn't applaud enough. I accept it from a Nancy Pelosi and the other fetid creatures from the jungle floor. I can scent their subversion through the TV screen. I accept it from the Democratic Socialists, but I couldn't believe I was watching the Republicans applauding. He walked down the aisle smiling as though he were on a red carpet in Hollywood. The world is burning around him, and this double agent tells us the world is perfect. All I could think of was Joseph Stalin when he was confronted with boys being raped and murdered on a railroad track in the 1950s. Stalin told the commander to remind his underlings, "There is no homicide in paradise. It only happens in a capitalist nation." I was watching that during the State of the Union speech, in which the cafe singer delivered a speech about a paradise that doesn't exist. Barry Hussein Obama is a small replica of other power-mad dictators. A form of religious genocide by silent complicity is being committed against Christians because the maniac in the White House won't lift a finger to protect them. He's a silent accomplice to the genocide going on against Christians in the Middle East, and he doesn't even talk about it. He tells us that the Iranians are our friends. They're our great friends. Well, friends don't supply arms and IEDs to terrorists. Iran does. They are used to kill innocent Christians and U.S. soldiers. Did you see the Navy men humiliated? Did you see them bowing down to the Iranian murderers the same way our president bowed to the Saudi king a few years back? Did you see them saying how well they had been treated in a prison camp? Do you know that behavior like this in another time would have been considered sedition? They might have been court-martialed when they came back, tried and executed for catering to the enemy. And it happened on the very day that the fraud gave the big smiling speech, the big smiling Obama glad-handing down on the runway. I don't understand where America went. It went up in smoke, without a fight, without protest from the media. This is not a right-wing view. This is a practical view. How can anyone see and yet not understand what just happened to this military? Two boats suddenly conk out and run aground, and they're rescued by Iran. The 9 men and 1 woman on board were detained by the Islamic Revolutionary Guards on Farsi Island. The unnamed sailor said it was a mistake. It was our fault, and we apologize for our mistake. I ask again, can anyone explain to me how those boats died and ran aground? They are the most advanced naval watercraft imaginable. How did they die? Anyone who is a boater knows it was sabotage. Those boats don't conk out. In the second novel of my Jack Hatfield series, A Time for War, one scene opens with a U.S. military helicopter suddenly plummeting to Earth in Afghanistan because a Chinese device had this revolutionary technology that could stop the rotors from turning. A Chinese agent fused the helicopter components and the helicopter crashed. A few scenes later, an FBI car is pursuing the bad guys in San Francisco. The police car stops in the street because a bad guy has a device that he presses a few keys on, and it stops the computers from operating in the police car. With our sailors? My guess is that somebody gave the codes to the Iranians, who then jammed the boat's computer systems. The computer systems stopped the boats. They went aground. They were given to the Iranians on a silver platter. Our advanced technology was given to the Iranians just as it was with the drones. Then we see the apology, and then we hear John Kerry congratulating himself for his great relationship with the terrorists in Iran. And nobody in the media sees the bigger picture. Obama's not a sellout. He's giving America away for free. Putin presses in Syria while Obama just bends. As President of the United States, I am mindful of the dangers that we face. They cross my desk every morning. I lead the strongest military that the world has ever known. Well, Barry's almost right. There's one little piece missing. I mislead the strongest military that the world has ever known. He has purged the military. Joseph Stalin executed his generals in the 1940s out of fear that they were plotting a coup against him, which they were not. And as a result, the Soviet military was unable to operate effectively. Similarly, other dictators have purged the military in paranoid fits. Hitler, for one. Kim Jong-un, the power-mad ruler of North Korea, for another. Today we are witnessing a similar purge, carried out not with bullets but with smears, innuendo, and spurious legal charges. But it is a purge of senior military officers nevertheless. The chapter Zero Military in my recent book, Government Zero, is a must-read. I actually named the generals that Barry has purged in order to foster the progressive Islamist takeover of the United States of America and the world. They have names. The administration has continued right from where my last book left off. Barry has eliminated one seasoned combat leader after another through smears and innuendos. He has demilitarized our military. It's all part of the progressive Islamic takeover of America, attacking at the core, another step in the ongoing purge and reconstruction of the military. The Obama administration continues its quest to transform the military from an institution of patriotic warriors, largely inspired by Christian principles, into an atheistic, multicultural, progressive bureaucracy, where male Marines receive sensitivity training in order to fight next to female Marines. My heart beats with sadness to see what's happened to this country and this military under this radical extremist in the White House. My personal feeling is that at the end of the day, now that Russia is so deeply enmeshed in the Syrian civil war, that country will constrain Hezbollah. I think Russia will be a stabilizing force in the Middle East rather than a destabilizing force. The greatest destabilizing force in the Middle East has been Barry from Honolulu and Hillary from Chappaqua. He came into office with zero foreign policy experience and learned nothing on the job. Hillary did even worse. She ignored anything she learned as a New York senator and used the State Department to enrich foreign donors to her foundation. When will you wake up to the fact that we have a sociopath in the White House who has destroyed the Middle East and wrecked our borders, language, and culture? yet he had the nerve to say the gravest threat to the world is global warming. Not ISIS, which has conquered a territory larger than Great Britain under his watch, if you want to call it his watch. Its fighters have raped and pillaged and beheaded their way across the Middle East. Finally, Putin said, "That's enough. You're not getting Syria. You're not taking out Assad. You're not taking away our warm water ports, period. End of story." And he frankly began to do the job that Obama said he himself was doing. Hey, we still have a warm water port, a bunch of them in Hawaii, where Barry from Honolulu body surfs on his endless vacations. But again, Barry was lying. He was not doing the job against ISIS. If he's been conducting airstrikes for more than 2 years, as he and the empty suits in his administration have been saying, why is ISIS still able to strike us at home? You're telling me our Air Force is that bad? We have the greatest Air Force in the world. At least we did, until Barry took over. Do you know who's running the Air Force now? A woman who never piloted an airplane. A glorified air traffic controller, that's who. He handpicked her, as he did Loretta Lynch, to feminize the Air Force, along with the Navy and the Marines. But the fact of the matter is that anyone can see that even though we have been bombing Syria for years to take out ISIS, we have failed. So, who has failed? Is it the brave young kids who fly the jets? No. It's not them. They could have taken ISIS out in a week. Many of them have even said so after they quit the Air Force because they couldn't believe what they were being forced to do. It's not the young men flying our jets who have failed in taking out ISIS. It's the commander in grief, the greatest thief of our sovereignty in the history of this republic. And I'm not saying that just to be glib. The thin man in the White House is the problem. The problem is Barry Obama from Honolulu, who is in so far over his head that even his most devout supporters recognize that the world is going up in flames. At the United Nations, something even more remarkable happened. As you know, England's former Prime Minister David Cameron and Obama are on the same page with regard to almost everything. Yet Cameron of England and Obama, who were debating Islamic extremism at the United Nations, had a little disagreement because Obama would not say one word about radical Islam. Even Cameron could not believe what he was listening to. Barry said, "Violent extremism is not unique to any one faith, so no one should ever be profiled or targeted simply because of their faith. Yet we have to recognize that ISIL is targeting Muslim communities around the world." Cameron answered back, "You said, and you're quite right, that every religion has its extremists. But we have to be frank that the biggest problem we have today is the Islamist extremist violence that has given birth to ISIL, to Al-Shabaab, to Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda, and so many other groups." Even milquetoast Cameron, the same guy who categorically would not meet with Donald Trump, until suddenly he would, had to step out of his loafers and say, "Even I can't swallow this one." Again, Obama won't say Muslim, Islam, and extremism in the same breath. So we are in a new world right now. Putin has pulled the trigger. Russia began its airstrikes using Su-34 fullback bombers. The biggest fear is that there will be a clash between U.S. fighter jets and Russian fighter jets over Syria. That would be the worst possible outcome. Russia demanded that the United States stop its own airstrikes, which is a joke unto itself. Excuse me, what airstrikes? Then we heard the Secretary of Misstatement, John Kerry, and the others trumpeting the airstrikes of the last years against ISIS, while ISIS has metastasized and morphed into worldwide terrorist attacks. What airstrikes? Which aspirin factories was Obama blowing up with our jets, wasting the precious resources of our fighter pilots on a charade, a paper war against ISIS? We know that he's not fighting ISIS, which is why ISIS has grown. Many of us believe that he has actually funded ISIS, supplied weapons to ISIS, and that ISIS is Obama's army, set up specifically to take down Syrian President Assad. When I started saying this, many of you thought I was crazy, but little by little, the truth of that has come to light, has it not? So the United States said to Russia, "No, we're not going to stop our airstrikes. We're going to continue them." But what exactly is the Democrats' strategy for the Middle East? Obama is bumbling, and we pray to God that the American people are smart enough not to replace him with Hillary Clinton. Never forget, it was Clinton's Arab Spring that let religious rivalries flourish, starting a regional meltdown and the world's refugee crisis. There are so many related elements to this story, including speeches by U.S. leaders as they come forward with their double talk. Kerry, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, who's only defending his idiot boss, and it's all about what? What's it really about? It's about bringing down Assad. Let's face it, Assad is a dictator. He's a very, very dangerous man. But he's not going anywhere because he is a puppet of Russia, and a useful puppet of Russia at that. Telling Russia to abandon Assad would be the equivalent of telling the United States to get rid of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. Don't get me wrong, I'm not putting Assad and Netanyahu into the same class of humanity. But do you think you're going to convince the Russians to abandon Assad? Why should they? And who is Assad? He is not a Sunni Muslim. He is a Shia, an Alawite, which is a branch of Shia Islam. He has never really been a follower of Islam. He's a scientist, a doctor. He was not educated in a madrasa, as was Obama. Did you know that Obama is probably more of a Muslim than Bashar Assad? Assad never went to a madrasa. Obama went to a madrasa in Indonesia. Assad was educated at the Arab-French Al-Haraya School in Damascus, where he became fluent in English and French. He went on to study medicine at the University of Damascus and graduated in 1988. He conducted his residency in ophthalmology at a military hospital outside Damascus. He then attended postgraduate studies at Western Eye Hospital in London, England. His father had been grooming his brother, Basil, as the future president, but in 1994, Basil was killed in an auto accident, and Bashar was recalled to Damascus to begin being groomed for the throne. And you should know this. Bashar al-Assad is even more moderate than his father, Hafez, who was also a moderate monarch. By the way, history shows us that Syria is one of the more tolerant of the Levant states, along with Jordan. He's a dictator, all right, and he certainly knows how to take care of the Islamists in his country. But make no mistake about it, it was the Arab Spring, initiated by Hillary Clinton and funded by George Soros, that brought about the nightmare of what's going on in Syria. So where does all this leave us? How did our relations with Syria get so bad? The fact of the matter is that there was a time when Syria was not on our hit list. No, not at all. What happened to change that? In 2009, U.S. relations with Syria turned negative. What happened in 2009? Barry from Honolulu became president. Barry from Honolulu refused to help Syria expel former Iraqi al-Qaeda fighters. Barry from Honolulu claimed that al-Qaeda was composed of innocent civilians. So before we go on and paint Assad as the evil devil, let's compare our current administration and Assad. We're witnessing an unprecedented situation in which a foreign power, Russia, starts airstrikes without notifying the United States and then tells our military to get out of the way. And our military puts a physics professor and contractor in charge of the Department of Defense. That's Ash Carter, a brilliant man in physics, Harvard University. Let us say a wonderful scholar in his field, worked as an advisor to military contractors for years. In case you don't know who Ash Carter is, he used to work for old Jimmy Carter. Long-time, wobbly, lifetime, left-wing fanatic, game player, bumbler. I heard him speak once. I was screaming. I said, if I were listening to this and I were a Russian leader, I would be laughing at America. It's bad enough having these girls talk. Now we have this guy, the head of the military, who comes out in a pink tie. On the day he's supposed to stand up for U.S. military might, he comes out in another pink tie and goes on and on saying, well, we don't personally see it in the same way they do, and I would hope that Russia would see it in our way and come to the... I've never heard anything like that. No one speaks that way. These are bureaucrats, academic bureaucrats, who are deeply ingrained in the structure of the country, especially the military, which has been purged by Barry. The purge has been going on for quite a while. I told you before about how Joseph Stalin executed his generals in the 1940s out of fear that they were plotting a coup against him. But they were not. And as a result of those purges, the Soviet military became unable to operate effectively. Other dictators have purged the military in paranoid fits. Today we're seeing the same thing going on with our military, a purge carried out not with bullets, but with smears, innuendos, and spurious legal charges. But it is nevertheless a purge of senior military officers. Why is Obama doing this? Why is this purge going? Because Barry from Honolulu wants to transform the military from an institution of patriotic warriors, largely inspired by Christian principles, into an atheistic, multicultural, progressive bureaucracy. Not only do Barry and his flunkies purge competent, battle-hardened officers and replace them with progressive academics such as Ash Carter, they also purge chaplains committed to their faith and replace them with pseudo-chaplains who are willing to accept the progressive worldview regardless of their faith. They are expected to be enthusiastic about Islam, even though it's the ideology inspiring the maniacs that our military is supposed to be fighting. We turn now to what's going on in the Middle East specifically. Russian airstrikes against Free Syrian Army Forces, not ISIS. Oh, really? The New York Times put out the big smear that Russia has no intention of taking out ISIS, which is ludicrous. This is just a prelude to taking out ISIS. I'm no military expert, but I certainly have studied military issues long enough to see how the game is played. You don't go after your primary enemy when there's another force on the ground that may stand in your way or harm your own soldiers unless you're a doofus. What you do is you take out the forces on the ground that may not be friendly to your forces and get rid of them, sweep them away, then go after your primary target. Right now, the Free Syrian Army can do grave damage to Russian troops who will be on the ground if they're not already there. And the Russians want to have a clear field. They want to go after ISIS fighters and kill them. They will not bring them back and let them spew their Islamic hatred for the West. They're going to kill them on the field. So do you agree with me that the enemy of our enemy is our friend? Who is our greatest enemy in the world? Is it Russia? Russia wasn't our greatest enemy until Obama messed things up and made it a personal vendetta. Russia was our ally. The Cold War was over. Things were going well. We had great trade and interaction with the Russian people and the Russian leadership. Then this bungler came along, surrounded by his dumb sorority, and now we have a Cold War turning into a hot war. No, it's not Russia that is our greatest enemy. It's radical Islam, the Islamist ISIS. It's the greatest enemy of civilization since Adolf Hitler. So if Russia's willing to do the job, what's wrong with that? Tell me why you would oppose that. Of course, you're going to tell me what you've read in the New York Times and then heard ad nauseum all over the media from CNN's Barbara Starr and other bovine members of the female persuasion. They're not taking out ISIS. They're taking out the Free Syrian Army. Well, look at the long-term strategy, Barbara, because once the Russian troops sweep the Free Syrian Army away, they'll go after ISIS. That's my guess. Of course, we don't know what might happen tomorrow. My gravest fear is that there'll be an accidental dogfight between Russia and the United States in the Middle East or elsewhere, like when their fighters buzzed our Navy in April 2016. A shootdown in those circumstances would be a nightmare for all of us. The way to avoid that is for Barry Obama to actually pay attention to the papers that cross his desk every morning instead of planning his next visit to the beach. How a top-secret caller blew Hillary's cover. I get a wide range of callers, all ages, from all parts of the country. Some of them want to vent, a few of them want to argue. I pretty much heard it all. But once in a while, there's someone who surprises me. Someone like the man you're about to meet. I'm going to recite our conversation pretty much verbatim, because the content was as extraordinary as the caller. It began when I came off a monologue and decided to go to the phones. Now, let's get back to some of my callers. Bert in Utah. What you have to say is original. Never heard it before. You claim you have 20 years national top secret security clearance. I have no reason to doubt you. You connected all of this up to follow the money and the gold standard. Bert, please, for the sake of continuity, start from the beginning. You have a full 5 minutes right now if you need it. Well, the reason I'm calling you is because I'm about to make it my life's work to put Barack Obama, Eric Holder, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton in prison. And if I end up missing, I want this information out. Long story short, Nixon took us off the gold standard, changed our currency from an asset-backed currency to a commodity as a petrodollar. He approached the royal family in Saudi Arabia. He approached the Egyptians. They were the two dominant forces in the Middle East. He sold them on the idea of the petrodollar. Got all the other Arab countries to fall in line. We put the Shah into Iran. We put Saddam Hussein into Iraq. We put Gaddafi in Libya. And for decades, we were controlling everything. That's how the U.S. dollar became the reserve currency, and everybody that wanted to buy oil from the Middle East had to buy the U.S. dollar to trade it for oil, so it became a commodity. Well, the Arab culture, if you take two Arabs that hate each other more than anything else, the one group that they hate more is the infidels. So even the Arab enemies will work together to cut out the infidels. So Gaddafi and Hussein got together, and they developed what they called the gold dinar. That was to replace the petrodollar. So they wanted people to buy the gold dinar, which they would trade for oil. When they started doing this, Gaddafi got taken out, Hussein got taken out, and we started screwing around over there again. Assad is one of the few regimes over there that was duly elected. He wouldn't play ball with us, so as we do, we play both sides against each other. the CIA trained both the rebels and a false flag force that was represented as Assad's people. Hillary Clinton... Wait. Hold on, Bert. That's an important point. We know that the CIA trained the so-called rebels to bring down Assad, because McCain accidentally leaked that, even though it had been leaked before. You're now alleging, on this national show, that the CIA set up a fake group? What's the name of that group? They were represented as Assad's people. Okay, so they set up a fake Syrian army allegedly under the direction of Assad, and they did what? They gassed their own people? If you remember, Dr. Savage, when the media reported that Assad was gassing the rebels, yes, they did an independent study on the gas. The gas that was used was not the same kind of gas that Assad had in his arsenal. It was gas that was being transported through Libya and through Turkey to these rebels because they wanted to stage an attack against the rebels that would enrage everybody. So the U.S. shipped gas over there, had them fighting the rebels, and the rebels fighting the false force and framing Assad. Wow. Okay, I got it. So let's bring it up to today. Is Assad as bad as ISIS? Worse? Or is he actually not as bad as we think? Ask that again, please. Is Assad, who is being made into the Hitler of our time by Obama, is he as bad as ISIS or worse than ISIS? Which side should we be on, Bert? He's not as bad as our government and our media is making him out to be. But he wouldn't play ball with us, and so we're framing him just like we framed all the rest. When we took out Noriega in Panama, I mean, you go through the whole history, and these are dictators and things that the U.S. has put into place. And when they start stepping out of line, then we have to go in and remove them. And so Assad was duly elected. He won the majority vote, but then all the meddling that the U.S. has done over there has so discredited him that the whole world's turning against him. And Russia knows better, which is why they're over there now defending him. But one of the points I want to make is when Chris Stevens found out about these weapons of mass destruction, the gas that was being smuggled in there, and the CIA's involvement, he threatened to expose it. And he was, wait, you're saying that the ambassador to Libya in Benghazi, who was beaten to death by a mob, you're saying they unleashed the mob on him because he was going to expose the United States double dealing in all of this? Yep. And Chris Stevens and his assistant. I'm in my car. I don't have my notes. Sean Smith, I think it was, were the only two in the conflict that were killed. And then the CIA outpost that was a few blocks away, they blocked any aid coming to the conflict. Chris Stevens and his aide were locked in a safe room by one of the consul employees, where one of them died. One of them was unconscious from smoke inhalation. And then the two SEALs that were trying to defend the CIA outpost that were